Friday will be the busiest travel day of the year at Chicago's airports. And if you're traveling through O'Hare, you may wind up running through a lot of people to make your connecting flight. Here's Mary Wisniewski with the Chicago Tribune.
There's a lot of things about O'Hare that are outmoded. You know, one, we have this international terminal, but the problem with it is that it's only an international terminal. You take a plane from California to Chicago and then have to, you know, dash, you know, all the way over to another terminal.
We get travel tips from some airport pros, plus...
I wanted to do something that was more meaningful, which meant, you know, wanted to do food that was closer to me, who I was as a person.
That's Chicago chef Bill Kim speaking at Google. If you're behind on holiday gifts, everyone likes food, right? Kim and some other foodies provide some recommendations for you. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As many folks are getting ready for the holidays today, we've got some suggestions for how to deal with your stress. Maybe by engaging in some procrastibaking. And on that same theme, if you're still looking for some gift ideas, we have some cookbook suggestions for you. We are less than a week from Christmas. And if you're anything like the team at the 21st, you're trying to get all of your work responsibilities squared away while also getting ready to travel. This Friday, an estimated 5.7 million people will go through Midway and O'Hare airports. That would make it one of the busiest travel days of the holiday season. And for some people, this is the time of year, just one of the few times they get out of town or out of state. All of that, of course, can also be stressful. So this morning, we've called up a couple of transportation and travel experts to help you out with their pro tips. Mary Wisniewski is a transportation reporter for the Chicago Tribune. She also writes the column Getting Around. She's on the line with us there from their newsroom. Hi, Mary. Happy holidays. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Same to you.
And also with us from Chicago is Jason Benetti. Maybe he's not an official expert, but we think he knows a little something about travel in his role as the play-by-play TV announcer for the Chicago White Sox. Hey, Jason, welcome back to the 21st as well. Happy holidays.
Thanks for having me, and I appreciate you setting the bar low for my advice.
Well, let's start, though, with what this time of year looks like for you travel-wise. Are you traveling for the holidays? How much have you been flying around for work? Just because it's the off season doesn't mean you're not working, right?
Yeah. So for my work for ESPN, I basically fly out once a week during football season and then a couple times during the week during basketball season. So I'm actually home for about an 8-day stretch right now, which is rare at this point. But I fly out on Christmas night, actually, to Arizona to do a football bowl game.
So how much time would you say you spend in airports every year, Jason?
Well, I do receive some mail at airports.
So at Midway or O'Hare stress. Or both?
No, I do Midway more than I do O'Hare. No, I would say if it's maybe 6 hours a week, multiply that. I mean, it's a couple hundred hours, I would say.
Jason, I think you just raised the bar, and now you are an official travel expert for us here on the air for the 21st.
No. Oh, no.
Mary, how, when we think about O'Hare and Midway, how does that compare to other American airports, especially as we're thinking about this week and this weekend?
This is a really, really busy weekend, a week for O'Hare because it's the hub airport for a lot of the nation, and it's starting to reclaim its crown as the busiest airport in the United States. It's catching up there with Atlanta, which it outclassed it for a while. And this is a very busy time for air travel all around the nation. This is, according to AAA, this is the highest level of air travel that they've seen for this holiday in 15 years, and it's about 4% higher than last year. So what's happening is that a lot of people, you know, the economy's pretty good, people have a little more money, and so that's driving a strong demand for traveling, not by air, by train, by car. So you're going to see a lot of people in the airports, you're going to see a lot of stress, and so our you know, advice is always just, you know, be chill, find things to do, find things for your kids to do, and know that everyone's just trying to get places at the same time as you.
So, Mary, let's think about preparation. And Jason, I'm going to ask you the same question in a minute, too. What is the best pre-flight preparation everyone needs to think about before they're headed, especially if they're doing Midway or O'Hare?
One of the things, best things you can do is make sure that you don't have anything on your carry-on bag that's going to raise the suspicion and ire of the people at TSA. So any liquid,
which includes everything like a snow globe, right?
Right, right. Things that contain liquid, you know, the bottle of brown liquor that you're bringing for your favorite uncle. You know, you have to pack that stuff in luggage that's going to be checked. And that's something that can really hold people up at the airport, hold you up, hold the people behind you up, you know, show yourself as an airport amateur.
Jason, this time of year is a lot of, I think part of the reason it gets so hectic is because you have the airport amateurs along with the seasoned travel pros such as yourself. How do you manage that balance?
Well, I think the key is to remember that so many people who are in the airport are there for the first time or they're on their first flight or only flight of the year. So, I mean, you leave yourself enough time to understand that there may be issues at TSA. Somebody may leave. Like, sometimes I'll get like a water bottle on a flight, like one of those little mini water bottles if I'm lucky enough to get upgraded. And then I'll leave it in there for the whole weekend that I'm at the football game.
And then you forget about it.
I'm a dope. Mm-hmm. And then I forget about it. And like, I travel all the time and I'm a dope sometimes. So like, understanding that people aren't meaning to cause you harm if you're in a hurry, you know, it's not their intent to slow you down. And to understand that sometimes things are going to go slightly haywire for the people in front of you. But I try to put anything that might look like something TSA would pull in a place that they can easily see it as they're scanning it. If I'm going somewhere warm, I don't wear my coat and I just pack it and I feel like I'm not going to get sick in the car on the way to the airport. It's just those like small things. And if you're a business traveler, like download anything you might be able to work on your iPad if you have one, or on your computer, so you don't rely on the Wi-Fi in the plane as well, would be one of my tips.
And Mary, to Jason's point about downloading, I wonder what advice you have for traveling with families this year, this time of year, especially when we're thinking about lots of kids. We were having this conversation in the office yesterday. One of our former producers was saying there was no way she wanted to get on a plane with three of her kids, all of whom are under the age of six. But there are going to be lots of people who are going to be traveling with kids that young, kids of all ages. So what kind of advice do you have for them?
Oh, I would, for people who are traveling with kids, make sure you have some activities for them to do, you know, whether it's drawing or puzzles or candy or maybe a new toy. You know, some new toys are, I used to pull this trick with my kids when we traveled, is if you get them something
save
new,
something,
it's
right.
Extra fascinating, right? Save something for the, you know, for when things get desperate. And for people who are traveling without kids, you know, be cool because, you know, you were a kid once and you're not helping matters by, you know, giving the mom a glare from across the aisle. And, you know, Santa's not going to be good to you if you're going to be acting that way towards a mom. So chill out.
I always feel so bad for the parents who apologize even before the flight starts. And I always tell them, you don't need to do that yet. Like, just, it's
That's
okay.
Right.
Maybe it won't be bad.
That's right. You know, and it's just a couple of hours of your life, you know, offer it up, you know, to the spirit of family and, you know, just try to relax.
So, Jason, let me ask you, are noise-canceling headphones the thing that you cannot live without when you travel?
That is definitely one of them. I like to go into, like, a place of forgetting that I'm even on a plane, if I can do it at all. But
how do you do that?
Well, you just put on the music that you really, really like, and you just put your head back, and you smile, and you take a deep breath, and there you are. You're wherever you are in your happy place, as they said in Happy Gilmore. But the other thing for me that has been helpful is one of those eye masks, because you don't realize, I don't think, how much better you might be able to sleep, even in like a hotel room where the curtain like very slightly, annoyingly stays slightly open, so there's that little sliver of light that comes through. Or on a plane when somebody's got the window shade open and you might not necessarily want it to be open. I like to have one of those eye masks in case I want to go to sleep. Now, that's not available for parents who are dealing with three kids and traveling as a large family. But if one of the parents wants to go to sleep and the other one, that is something that's helped me quite a bit.
So I think one of the things I always do is I have a little bag that's kind of my airplane bag, and it's my essentials bag. And in that, I have an eye mask. I have a set of earplugs in case something happens to my noise-canceling headphones. I have lip balm. I have Tylenol. Mary, Jason, what do you guys have in your little I have to get on a plane bag?
A rosary, you know, because I don't like flying. I also always bring along a pretty substantial paperback book in case of delays.
Jason?
Yeah, a book for sure in case of delay. And in order to do work when I need to, I always have my iPad with me because you can have that open at all times. And I have a cribbage app on my iPad for when I get bored with my book, I play cribbage.
And excellent idea.
Yeah, that's a good one. What do you guys think about neck pillows? Is that a waste of time?
I just had a conversation with a friend of mine about this who travels a lot for ESPN as well. And he was like, I am so disappointed that the neck pillow didn't help me as much as I expected.
I'm always amazed at how terrible that technology is. I would think it would have advanced to a much better place than it has at this point.
Agree.
I don't like them, but my kids have liked them. And it's helped them. And whatever helps get them through the plane ride, I'm cool with.
So let's talk about Midway and O'Hare. Jason, I'm going to start with you. Are there places that you like to hang out? Are there good secret spots that you're willing to share, or good places where you like to plug in if you are stuck for a delay? Or hopefully you've planned ahead, you've gotten to the airport really early, and then you're kind of at the gate waiting. Where do you like to hang out, Jason, at Midway?
So rather than the gate, because there aren't a ton of seats at the gates at Midway, I like to, especially if I'm right at like A7 or something like that, right when you cross the moving walkway going into A, there's a row of seats, and a small portion of them are for passengers with disabilities, but the rest of them are open for everybody. And I like to sit in the everybody seats right past the moving walkway, because everybody walks past that, it seems like.
And that's between the food, right? Is that between, like,
yeah,
where that candy store is and where, like, the nuts place is? Is that around
exactly.
there?
Exactly. It's between the food and like, A5. There's, like, a hot dog stand further along on the left, or a, you know, a little sports bar-y sort of thing. But, yeah, they're right on the left by the windows. If you're walking along that moving walkway, right on the left side, and you can kind of get some peace and quiet there.
Mary, what about O'Hare? I'm going to share with all of the 21st listeners my favorite secret spot. If you fly American, I don't know the United Terminal as well, but between G and H in front of the Admirals Club there, there's a big area that's just kind of a weird connector hallway that is a pretty quiet area that I think is a great place to go if you are flying American. What are other places to think about in O'Hare?
Well, when flying international, I usually like to wander around the duty free shop because it's quiet in there and you can distract yourself pretty well. Depending on where I'm flying from, and rather than go with quiet, I go with conversation. So I like to go to the bar, and because that's where you can talk to people. You might find someone from another state or another country to talk to. It depends on how you like to fill your time. I usually like to spend it in conversation because that makes the time go by.
And Mary, you mentioned the international terminal. That's a good point for people who are flying out of O'Hare to remember to plan for enough time, especially if they're transferring.
Right. Right. You have to have all of your documents in order and on the top of your luggage so that you're not hunting around for them, because those lines can be really bad.
The one thing we've spent a lot of time talking about air travel, Mary, I just wanted to end by asking you a little bit about the roads, how many people we think are going to be hitting the roads this year, what people should be thinking about in terms of travel, particularly across the Midwest.
Sure. The roads are going to be extremely busy this year. AAA has predicted that it's going to be something like 102 million people, and it's the most since AAA began tracking holiday travel.
Wow.
And it's because of low gas prices.
I was going to say, gas prices are so low, right?
Right. And the worst days are going to be, in Chicago, it'll be on the 24th. There'll be, two and a half times the traffic as usual. So, again, the key is to be patient. Don't talk on your mobile phone while you're driving, because this causes crashes, it causes problems. Don't, if you're going to be drinking during the holidays, let someone else take the wheel. So that's the best thing to remember is
don't
that,
text while you're driving too.
And don't text while you're, because some studies show that the amount of distraction that this involves and the amount of skill that it takes away from you is actually worse than drunk driving. So we really have to break that habit as a country, because the idea about the holidays is to be with your families and to be happy and to be safe, and no one's going to appreciate it if you end up in the hospital. So you take your time, be patient, and be safe.
Mary, I bet we've got a lot of folks listening throughout the state who are going to be driving through Chicago for the holidays. What's your best advice for them when they are have to, if they have to go through Chicago on their way to either Wisconsin or Michigan?
Well, don't if you can avoid it, don't go on Christmas Eve, because that's going to be the worst time. Between about 1:30 and 2:30 in the afternoon, that's going to be the worst time, especially going through the Jane Byrne interchange going on the Kennedy. If you can avoid the interchange, if you want to pay the toll, the best thing to do would be to take 294.
Right, take the Skyway.
Or take the Skyway, to avoid, to avoid going through the interchange. And if you can travel a day earlier, that would be better, because the 24th is the worst day.
Jason, any final words of advice for everyone as folks are traveling this holiday season?
One of you two just said the word patience, and I think that's the key. Just remembering that everybody in the airport started the day hopefully with as much of a smile as you did, and everybody that you're running into might have another story of woe this travel season, or they could have lost a family member,
right,
or they might have just had a fight with their loved ones, or their flight was delayed for 10 hours. And the same goes for gate agents and people working for TSA. Everybody has something in their heart that they want to be happy and healthy, and just remember that as you're clanging off of people in the terminals.
That's
a great reminder for everyone. Happy holidays, and thank you very much to Jason Benetti, who was our TV play-by-play announcer for the Chicago White Sox, and Mary Wisniewski, transportation reporter, getting around columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Happy holidays, guys. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to join us. I appreciate it.
Hey, happy holidays.
Thank you.
Bye.
Support for the 21st comes from Sock Club, delivering new designs of socks each month made with cotton grown and knit in the southeastern United States. Gift subscriptions are available this holiday season to keep friends and family in socks year-round. More information is available online at sockclub.com.
Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are continuing our holidays hour. You just heard, maybe if you haven't just tuned in, we were hearing some travel tips from a couple of Illinois airport experts. And we're continuing, as I said, to do that holiday theme. Are you done with your shopping yet? Maybe you still need to pick something up, especially if you're thinking about a gift for the home cook in your life. Well, thankfully, there are plenty of excellent cookbooks to choose from. And we are going to be talking to a couple of Chicago cookbook authors in a few minutes. But first, Monica Ng hosts the Chewing Podcast. She's also a reporter with WBEZ Chicago. She joins us from there now. Hi, Monica. Welcome back to the 21st. Good morning. Happy holidays.
To you too, Nyla.
So we've got a lot of your suggestions here, but before we get to your suggestions and the list you've created for us, what, in your opinion, makes a good cookbook?
Well, it should look fantastic. I mean, I love great pictures, but it should also not just be the recipes. I really want to hear a story about the recipe, because that's what gets me into it. And then the recipes have to work. A lot of people, say that it's the end of the recipe. There was a big story this year that we don't need cookbooks anymore. Tyler Florence said he wasn't going to write anymore. But I still think there's something wonderful about having it in your hand and paging through and looking at these pictures and reading these stories and getting inspired.
Well, and when you think about that, the whole idea of the end of printed cookbooks, what's your defense against that?
Well, I mean, for trees, it's no good. But I do love, you know, just sitting down on the couch on, you know, those days when I have nothing to do, which is forever not. But on those days, like I've been sick for the last 2 days and I had a stack of cookbooks next to me. And I really love that tactile experience of looking at the pictures and paging through. But so I guess that would be the one defense. But, you know, do you need it? I was making something called coquito the other day. It's this Puerto Rican Christmas drink.
Puerto Rican eggnog.
Exactly, you know it. And, you know, I could find 17 recipes, including videos, online at the, you know, the touch of a button. So do you really need them to cook? Not sure.
I like this time of year, Monica. You know how much I like to bake, because this is the one time of year that I actually pull out my actual cookbooks and I go back to, like you were talking about coquito. I was making a Trinidadian version and I have a cookbook from my mom's school in Trinidad that has all of my favorite recipes. And I also was making the pancha crema from that. All of my favorite cookie recipes I have saved in paper. I wonder how hard it is to get a cookbook for someone if you don't know very much about their cooking habits. How can you kind of sneakily find out what would be a good cookbook for somebody?
You can ask them what kind of food they like to cook, or what kind of aspirational food they'd like to cook, or their favorite dish at a restaurant that just seems unattainable, and then you can, like, get that recipe for them. I mean, I think those are some of the ways, you know, usual sneak tactics.
And do you think that every recipe needs to have a picture with it?
I know it's more expensive, especially full color pictures with them, but I love that. That's kind of what tantalizes me. That gives me a clear idea of what this is supposed to look like when I'm done.
Yeah, I feel like if there's not a picture, I don't want to use it.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to some of your recommendations. Let's start with Eat a Little Better by Sam Kass. What do you like about this? And remind us who Sam Kass is for folks who aren't familiar with him.
Well, Sam Kass was a Chicago chef, actually worked at a VEC here, and then he became the cook for the Obamas, and then he became the White House chef, and then he became the executive director of Michelle Obama's Let's Move. Now he's doing private stuff, but he wrote this book, and what he wanted to do with it was say, okay, you don't have to, like, overnight go vegan. You don't have to make sure everything is 100% organic in your house, but let's make small improvements. Let's eat some more plant-based food. And this cookbook really helps you with that. It tells you how to make your vegetables really delicious in not really difficult, complicated ways, like charring romaine lettuce, making kale chips, broiling your, roasting your broccoli, stuff like that.
What's the best way to roast broccoli, according to Sam Kass?
Well, you just toss it in some olive oil, put some garlic in there, salt it, give it a nice, like, 400 heat until you see that caramelization on there, flip it, and then bring it out. And it's got this, like, sweetness from the roasting caramelization that nobody can resist. You know, I'd say put a little tahini, a little bit of
miso?
Red pepper on it, miso, anything to give it that sort of acid salt.
We're talking cookbooks with Monica Ng, and she has a list of recommendations that we're going to tweet out, but we'd love to hear your suggestions as well. If you want to call us, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. There's another cookbook you have on your list here. It's Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook. Are these kind of more simpler everyday meals?
Absolutely. It's stuff that you can cook pretty much overnight. I mean, one of the recipes that I'm most enchanted with is this ricotta spoonable. Basically, you take ricotta cheese, some fresh herbs, a little bit of salt, and some olive oil, and then you mix it all together, and then you just smear that on some crackers or some toast, and it's really delicious, and it's sort of like this dip that you wouldn't expect from the queen of baking and, you know, serious
from Dory Greaseban.
Right.
Oh, okay. And then it's that sounds like it's a savory ricotta, then it sounds like?
Yep.
Okay. So we have been talking cookbooks with Monica Ng. Oh, Monica, there's another one you just added to the list. Heritage Baking. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. You know, Ellen King, who runs the wonderful Hewn Bakery in Evanston, has come out with this wonderful book that celebrates Illinois farmers. I believe you had some on recently.
And actually, Ellen King is joining us in a few minutes, too. So perfect pick, Monica.
Yeah, I love Ellen. And her, if you can make it out to Evanston and get one of those loaves, it is like life-changing. And I've heard some people say, I'm not a doctor here, so I'm not going to, like, back it up. I've heard some people say that even those who are sensitive to gluten can sometimes eat breads that are long fermented and using these heritage grains. And it really makes a great argument for why you would want to make your own bread and get some of these grains that are grown right here in Illinois on organic farms.
Right. We were just, in fact, Janie's Organics in Bloomington, we were having that conversation a couple of weeks ago about his grains and his heritage grains. So as we're talking cookbooks with Monica Ng, she is a reporter at WBEZ Chicago. She is co-host of the Chewing podcast, which you can find from the Chicago Tribune. I wanted to bring on a couple of guests who are on Monica's list. They are both from Chicago. Chandra Ram is the editor of Plate Magazine and author of The Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook. She also co-authored a book with Bill Kim, who's also joining us, an award-winning Chicago chef, best known for his restaurants, including Belly Q and Urban Belly. I very much miss Belly Shack. Their book is called Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. Chandra, Bill, welcome to the 21st. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays
to you,
too.
Chandra, let's start with you and with the Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook. I want to ask you about folks, if people haven't gotten an Instapot or if maybe they will be getting one this Christmas, why you think they're so good, why you think they're particularly suited for Indian cooking.
Well, thank you. I mean, as I'm sure you know, pressure cooking is huge in traditional Indian cooking. And when I was growing up, I grew up in the U.S., but my father is from the state of Andhra Pradesh, and we used to go to his hometown to stay with my grandparents and aunts and uncles every year, every other year. And I always saw these very, like, the traditional stovetop pressure cookers on the stoves there. And it's just the fact that for a long time in India, people depended on propane stoves as opposed to, like, the gas or electric stoves that we use here in the U.S. And those were just a more consistent way to cook. And pressure cooking is fantastic for Indian cooking because you're cooking with lentils, you're cooking with rice, you're doing lots of long braises. And this is a way to accomplish all of that in a lot less time. So that if you have a meal that's going to have rice, that's going to have lentils, that might have some long braised greens or meat, you can do all of that without each one of those things taking all day.
And I, as a child, grew up terrified of my mother's pressure cooker because I just was always warned away and told horror stories of do not touch it, it will explode. Instant pots are much safer.
Oh my gosh, we were all afraid of those things because even
I don't know if that was just an Indian mom statement, but I feel like she definitely was like, stay away from the pressure cooker.
My mother wouldn't allow me in the same room. Like, I would be, you know, in Vizag at my grandparents' house, and I would, like, take it, and she'd be like, get out of there. That thing is going to explode. She was just like, no. And then even when they don't explode, you have to wait and listen for the whistles. And it's just sort of not how we live today, definitely not in America. So the Instant Pot is just a complete game changer for anyone who wants to cook Indian food.
Right. Electric pressure cookers, we should say, safer. Chandra Ram. Bill Kim is also with us. Bill, when we think about, Chandra was just mentioning braising. I wonder when we think about the growth of Korean food around the world and especially in the U.S., how do you think Korean barbecue fits into that picture?
I think first and foremost is able to kind of demystify Asian food because people think it's such a hard thing to do. Where do you find ingredients? So when we wrote the cookbook, we thought about the end users and where can they get a lot of these ingredients at their local grocery store. So the idea started from there and try to have our general audience be able to replicate some of these things. And Korean flavors are, you know, a lot of chefs are now using it. And I promise you, if you go to any restaurant in the country, you will have kimchi at an American restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, or even, you know, a burger place will have a kimchi burger someplace. So it's flooded the market and it's here. It's a mainstay now.
I wonder what it's like for you guys to write a cookbook. And Bill, how is this different from coming up with recipes that you're using at your restaurants when you're thinking particularly about home cooks?
You know, it's actually harder because you're thinking about what the home cooks have at their house. And the way we did it is you're reusing a lot of the master sauces, using it over and over again, so you don't have to take out 7 bowls. You don't have a dishwasher. You don't have prep cooks. So it's one individual that's going to execute this. So we really thought about how we could simplify and demystify the ingredients so it's easy for them to be able to execute the idea of Korean barbecue. So simplification and accessibility was a key to when we were writing this.
Chandra, what would you say is the hardest part about writing a cookbook that you think people might not be aware of?
You know, I think, I would echo a bit of what Bill was saying in that you really have to get out of, you have to approach writing a cookbook with a certain amount of expertise in your subject, but then you have to, while editing it, take yourself out of that place and say, okay, what would someone who has no idea how to grill or no idea about what Indian food is like, what questions would that person have? One of the things that I did with the Indian book is have people who had just gotten Instant Pots test the recipes for me, and people who weren't very familiar with Indian food, and their feedback was amazing. I mean, that's how I went through and added a lot of extra information because people were calling me and saying like, hey, I don't know about this, or wow, I use brown rice instead of white rice. Is that going to change anything? And I was like, oh my gosh, yes it is, yes it is. But like, thank you so much. Now I know. So, you know, it's all of that, but it's, I mean, I find it an incredibly rewarding process. I was waiting for Bill to talk about how great it was since we wrote that book together, Bill, but.
We used a lot of technology to get this, the book actually done, and it was going back and, you know, I write one chapter, send it to Chandra electronically. She edited. As she was editing it, I could also see what she's editing, so I could go back, write the story again. So even though it is a long process, I really enjoyed it, and it was very therapeutic for me to go back in time to talk about my childhood and some of the things that I went through. So even though the recipes are great, it also is telling of my childhood, how I grew up in Chicago.
Mm. And I wanted to ask Bill Kim, Chandra Ram, I wanted to ask both of you as well. Both of your these cookbooks, whether it's the Korean Barbecue Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces or the Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook, did you write those for people who are not Asian for people who maybe aren't familiar with the food and introducing them to the food? Is it for people that's their family and maybe they're learning about their ancestral cooking for the first time? Or did you think about what audience that would be when you all were putting the cookbook together? Both of them, I guess. Bill?
Chandra, you want to go first?
Oh, Chandra, go ahead.
Well, I mean, for me, I sort of found myself a little bit in that situation because I'm half Indian. But, I grew up with a mother who was born and raised in Ireland, and that's who cooked most of the Indian food I ate when I was growing up. And so I felt a little bit of imposter syndrome of like, oh, my gosh, you know, how am I writing this Indian cookbook? But then I, said, OK, this isn't going to be the most traditional book. This is going to be a book from someone who is Indian by heritage and considers it part of herself, but also who grew up in the South and who cooked in restaurants in the 90s and who, who's lived in different parts of the U.S. And so that to me is, I was writing it specifically, frankly, for people who aren't necessarily Indian because I knew Indians would understand it, but I wanted to make sure I explained everything in a way so that if you were intimidated by Indian spices, by some of the terminology in that, I was breaking down that barrier because I had needed that, and I definitely relate to that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Bill, I want to hear a little bit more about your story as well, the family stories that you put into this book, as you were saying, into this cookbook. And Monica Ng, I want to hear what you liked about these cookbooks as well. So when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bill Kim. He's a Chicago chef. He and Chandra Ram are co-authors of Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. She's also the cookbook author of the Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook. Monica will give us the rest of her recommendations as well. And we'd love to hear from you if you've got some suggestions for cookbooks, gift ideas. You can tweet us to 21STShow. I'm Nyla Budu. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation just after the short break. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. One of the favorite things everyone loves about the holidays is food and gifts. We have combined both of those to talk about gifting cookbooks. We've got a couple of folks on the line from Chicago who are talking to us about their food. Bill Kim is a Chicago chef. You may know him from his Chicago restaurants, including Belly Q and Urban Belly. He, along with Chandra Ram, have co-written a cookbook called Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill in 7 Sauces. Chandra is also the author of the Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook. Monica Ng from WBEZ has been with us as well. And Bill, before the break, we were just talking about stories and families. I wonder, you were talking about one of your favorite parts of the cookbook was that you were able to share stories of your life. You were born in Seoul. You immigrated to the U.S. when you were 7. As you were going back through, I wonder what role you realized food played in your life, especially when you were growing up.
Sure. It was very strange time for me when I immigrated. I was 7. I was learning the Korean language. Then I got kind of uprooted to come to the States. And here I am in between two different cultures, one that I needed to forget, Korea. Then I came to Chicago. I kind of needed to kind of find another identity. So there was culture clash between forgetting one culture and adopting another. And, you know, when I started going to school, I would never get a sandwich. I would have rice and some kind of braised item in my lunchbox. And I was in, you know, I was seeing what the other kids were eating and people did not understand what's the smelly.
Why you had curry in your lunchbox? That was my story. Right.
So that kind of, you know, as I was writing the book, I'm like, I need to tell these stories. So one of the recipes, we called it Force Deserve Drive, Korean barbecue skirt steak, because one of the things that we did when we were growing up, we didn't have enough money to get a grill. So where do we find a free grill? It's at the Forest Preserves. So Sundays after church, we would go find a grill, and we would have the Korean barbecue marinade in short ribs or skirt steak, and we would just have these big picnics with our family members. Then you would see, remember Popeye Wimpy with hamburgers? We would also get strangers that would smell the Korean barbecue, would come, and my mom would feed people that never had it. So I'm like, this is what it's all about. It's food, it's made deliciously, and be able to also share with strangers. And that just put a huge smile on my face as I was writing these recipes. It just kind of took me back as, you know, 8, 9, 12, 13 year old kid and just reminiscing about how I grew up as a kid. And that just really tells the story of the book and also of my life and what it felt like to be an immigrant, to come here, to be able to share that experience.
Monica, what did you like best about Chandra and Bill's cookbooks?
Well, I love the accessibility of them, but also, you know, the ability to look at these more complicated sauces. And I say more complicated because they've got complicated flavors, but actually they seem like they'd be really easy to make, like that Korean pesto with the kimchi in it, but also a bunch of basil. You know, that sounds fantastic. And yeah, I love making Korean barbecue and knowing how to marinate that at home so that you can impress your family and friends at barbecues. That's fantastic. And gorgeous pictures.
Bill, is the marinade the key to understanding Korean barbecue?
I think it is. It's also time, and it's also not, you're having underutilized cuts of meat that people don't know about. And also, if you don't have the time, cut it a little bit thinner and give it less time to marinate. And you could just, you know, you feel like you spend hours when you cook Korean barbecue, but when you taste it and it takes a little time as possible, and you could also, if you want to, you could freeze it and eat it for the next couple of weeks, because that's what my mom did. She cooked on Sundays, so we would have Korean barbecue anytime we wanted. We just had to defrost like a pound, and we would have for the entire family that night.
That's Bill
Kim. That sounds so good.
Yeah, that sounds so great. That's Bill Kim, Chicago chef, co-author of Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill, and Seven Sauces. Chandra Rama is also with us. She's also co-author of that, as well as the Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook. And we've got Ellen King with us, joining us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston at the Medill School of Journalism. Ellen is the co-owner of Hewn Bakery. Monica was talking about her cookbook. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to ask you, and then Chandra, if you could weigh in after this, that would be great. Ellen, when you're doing a cookbook and it's all about baking, what do you think is the most, what was the hardest thing for you? What was the hardest thing for you to think about when you were putting it together?
Oh, geez. Well, there were so many things that I found difficult that honestly, for me, it was the measurements, trying to, you know, organize how we bake and making it in like cups and ounces and converting to grams. So it was like, I would get so confused. That was like a nightmare, actually.
Yeah, I know it's hard. And I was actually saying this to my niece last night. I was saying I've been experimenting with gluten-free flour for baking, and it was a very frustrating process. And I was just thinking, if you just follow the recipe with all of the ingredients in it, it always turns out great. But when you start messing with things when you're baking, sometimes things just can go really badly wrong. Right, Ellen?
Yeah, sometimes things turn out terribly. And, you know, with baking, I think what's frustrating is, so, you know, it happens at the bakery too, where we'll try something and it doesn't look right. And then we eat it and we know, oh, we probably forgot to add salt.
Right. Forgot to add salt.
Yeah.
Chandra, before we let you go, I know you have to go here. I wonder if there's any last recipes or any recipes you'd like to share with us and leave us with from your cookbooks.
You know, I think that, you know, there's a few that if you are new to Indian food and cooking, make great sort of first steps. Certainly, I will say the butter chicken is something that everybody, even if they're a little unsure of Indian food or haven't experienced much of that, that's something that's very popular. But then as well, there's some fun things like there's a coriander onion chutney that would go so well on any kind of holiday entertaining table, you know, great with cheeses. There's persimmons chutney, there's a cranberry chutney. So there are a lot of things that can kind of be like a little bit, if you're new to Indian foods and flavors, that can be like a little bit of your entry, your gateway to it, for sure. But I mean, it's just get in there, try it, go easy on the chilies if you're afraid of that, and then you can always add in more. But have fun. It's cooking and food, and it's the holidays, and that's what we really want for everyone to do.
Well, thanks to Bill and Chandra. Chandra Ram is the editor of Plate Magazine, the cookbook author of The Complete Indian Instant Pot Cookbook, and co-author of Korean Barbecue, Master Your Grill and Seven Sauces, which she co-wrote with Bill Kim. Chandra, Bill, happy holidays. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
And so, Ellen, as we're thinking about the whole idea of cookbooks and baking, Monica Ng is still with us as well. Monica knows this about me because Monica spent a lot of time with me and she knows that I like to procrastinate.
But it's delicious.
It is delicious. Well, baking for me is a stress reliever and I never want to eat it. I just want to make it. I wonder when you first started baking, Ellen.
Well, I guess I got my start really procrastinating baking because I was I moved here from Seattle and I had worked in kitchens, but I was not a baker because I'm really not too exact and I'm not good in math. And so I was home with a young son and I just became obsessed with bread and kind of just taught myself everything I could about making bread. And it kind of fit really easily with the schedule of having, you know, at the time a two-year-old that would be napping. So my obsession with bread would really coincide with nap time and when I'd take him to school and everything. So, yeah, a career out of procrastibaking, kind of.
So we should probably define what procrastibaking is. I should say that this term has been hashtagged on Instagram more than 30,000 times. I'm only responsible for maybe like 1,000 of those. Can you define what procrastibaking is for us, Ellen?
Well, if you're a student, it's like, you know, baking in the middle of, you know, before studying or doing an exam or doing homework. For me, being a parent, it was, you know, not doing the laundry or doing bills. It was like anything to like get away from what I really needed to do that day. Then I ended up becoming obsessed with baking. So it's a good way to kind of fill your time and maybe relieve stress, but really not do what you kind of should be doing.
Monica, you do this with cooking.
I do. I try to find the most complicated recipe possible.
Especially when it's cold. Yeah. I know you like to just start cooking.
Yeah, and it also makes the house smell great. If it's the right dish, if it's not something with a lot of Brussels sprouts or broccoli, it makes the house smell terrific. And I think that's important.
Ellen, so can I ask you about your book, Heritage Baking, which includes almost 50 recipes for making bread? I wonder when we think about baking, there's just something that's, you know, obviously since the beginning, I mean, that was really our first. I wonder how much you think that was our history of cooking, how important baking plays a role in that and how much you think recipes have changed over the time.
Well, I think baking, I mean, there's a reason why bread is a part of basically every culture, every religious ceremony. There's something involved with, you know, whether it be a type of grain, yeast and water, essentially, and sitting down and sharing that with people. So, I mean, I think that's universal. It's literally, I think, in our DNA. I'm not a scientist, but I think there might be like a bread part in that genome somewhere. But I think that it's core to really you know, memories that you have even as a kid baking. You know, I mean, my mom wasn't a good cook, but she loved to bake. And I think a lot of people look at baking as something more approachable, even though it is, you know, a little bit more scientific. Even though I say that my book is a lot more about bringing kind of the art rather than the science into baking. And I think that's important because over the years after, I think after World War II, it started becoming really a science. And we start losing our soul of, you know, connecting with the grains and the farmers and, you know, making baking be about the experience and not so much about being exact and scientific.
Mm. Before we go, I just want to ask you a quick question about the name of your bakery. That actually has historic ties as well. Can you tell us a little bit about Hewn?
Yeah, so I got my master's in history, and literally what I got from that was I worked on the coast of Maine restoring a house, and I found some hewn beams that dated the house to like 1803 in Maine. And that name, like a hand-hewn, something hewn, to me was always something that was the sign of an artist doing something special, and it carried throughout generations. And when I was going to do the bakery, I'm not French. I'm like as American as they come. And I really wanted a word that reflected, you know, my Americanism, I suppose, which just being, you know, English. I don't speak another language. And hewn was an old English word that is, you know, a sign of like an artisan, a stone maker, a wood maker. And, you know, now hopefully it's attributed to a baker.
Thanks for that. Monica, one last question for you. For folks who are still looking to buy gifts or thinking about a cookbook, how can you tell whether a cookbook's for a beginner, a home cook, or someone who's an expert?
Well, start paging through it. You know, look at the amount of ingredients and the preparation time. I would, you know, yeah, for most people, I'd give them beginner stuff. But then there's always those people like our old colleague, Al Keefe, who wants to make
his own turkey.
Exactly. And makes his own bouillabaisse and cassoulet and his own bibimbap. So there are those people, too.
Okay. I want to thank WBEZ's Monica Ng. You can find her podcast, Chewing, which is all about food with Louisa Chu. And Ellen King for joining us. She's the co-owner of Hewn Bakery in Evanston. And we've also been talking about her cookbook, Heritage Baking. Both of you, happy holidays. Thanks for being with me.
To
I appreciate
too.
It.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be speaking with Chicago area writer Alec Nevila Lee about his new book that describes what it was like in the early days of science fiction. These are the guys who laid the groundwork for things that we now consider part of our mainstream, like Star Wars and Star Trek. And we'll wrap up our series of holiday conversations by speaking with Reggie Ponder about the best movies that are out in theaters. If you have the NPR One app, that's a great way to listen to us. You download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, set your home station, and if you search for The 21st, it's the 21ST to follow us. It's a good way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. All those links, if you want to contact us on social, if you want to follow us on social media, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.